Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Man who has brought uncommon intelligence to bear for many years on behalf of our country is our first guest. He will be with us for two segments, I'm very pleased to say. He is Judge Michael Mukasey, also known as General Michael Mukasey, because he served with great distinction as the 81st Attorney General of the United States. But for many years, he was a judge in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, including serving for some time as its chief judge. Also, a federal prosecutor before all of that, now with a law firm in New York City. It is a great pleasure to have him with us here on Secure Freedom Radio. General, Judge, welcome. Good to have you, sir.
Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to talk with you about a theme that I address in a commentary today about the Obama legacy and its potential implications, ominous implications at that, for public safety. And maybe we might just touch them off examples of the problem and ask you to address it as you see fit. I'm concerned about our borders remaining open and the president extending by executive action amnesty. To the extent that that has resulted in not just large numbers of illegal aliens coming here, but quite possibly others who may wish to do us harm, should we be concerned about the public safety implications?
Well, I'm sure we should be concerned. You'll notice in all the photographs of the people fleeing the violence in principally in Syria, they somehow seem to be all relatively young males.
Funny how that is, isn't it?
Yeah, one notices very few families. One notices large numbers of what one might call draft age at another time.
Jihadist age is the way I think of it these days.
That's another way to think of it. And I think it's altogether possible that there are a substantial number of those people who are intent on doing just that. And it's very difficult. In fact, it's close to impossible to screen them out.
Well, we've certainly heard that with respect to another of these initiatives of the president, the idea of bringing perhaps 100,000 of these Syrians here. With the FBI director and the director of national intelligence saying there is no way to vet them in the absence of any kind of background information on them. Again, it would seem this is an affront to common sense as well as national security.
It would seem. It's almost as if people are applying to this the same formula that the former Speaker of the House applied to the healthcare bill. We have to pass it in order to find out what's in it. Here, we have to admit them in order to find out who they are. I think that's the wrong way to do it.
Judge, you were recently testifying on Capitol Hill about another initiative, and I gather that you're a little bit more sanguine about it than I am. Talk a bit about the practice that the president has begun this past weekend of releasing large numbers of criminals associated, I believe, with drug crimes from American prisons, and the possibility that there might be a lot more of that if there's a so-called criminal justice reform bill enacted by the Congress.
I think it's important to separate out what I was testifying about from what happened this past weekend. What happened this past weekend, I think, was a manifestation of the change in the guidelines relating to drug crimes, and that is not the subject that I was testifying about, and that is something that was done, as you point out, by administrative fiat. The Guidelines Commission changed the guidelines. They were applied retroactively, and people are being freed. That was not what I was talking about.
Well, before we get to what you were, is that of concern? Do you think that these folks are likely to be recidivists, as they say?
It is a concern. It is a concern. There's one of two possibilities. Either they go back to the street corner where they got picked up, or they go to work for IBM. And I don't think they go to work for IBM. So absent some coherent plan to monitor these folks and reintroduce them into the communities whence they came, and I know of no such plan. We're looking at the possibility of a spike in drug crimes.
And to the extent, you've obviously had a lot of experience with all kinds of criminal misconduct in your courts and the Justice Department, General Mukasey. To the extent that the argument is now being made that these are nonviolent drug offenders, is that in fact oxymoronic?
It is an oxymoron because you look at the way drugs are distributed. And these people, by the way, are not charged with using drugs. I've never seen a case in federal court prosecuted for simple possession or for using drugs. Anything that gets bargained down to simple possession started out as a sale. And the people who are in federal prisons are people who are there because they sold drugs, often because they sold drugs with attendant violence. Certainly the distribution of drugs is itself impossible without either violence or the threat of it. So the notion of a nonviolent drug offender is, for those reasons, I think, an oxymoron.
Well, and the idea that they may get back to what they were doing before they were incarcerated is a problem for the society, needless to say. So do talk a little bit about the criminal justice reform measure that is now before the Congress.
Part of this resulted from pressure from both liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans to get rid of mandatory minimums entirely and leave it all to the discretion of federal judges. And I think that's a mistake. I think Congress certainly has a voice. The people have a voice in at least a minimum sentence that should be imposed in certain kinds of crimes. The legislation that we're talking about is, in essence, a compromise because it does, although it does diminish some mandatory minimums, it keeps mandatory minimums in place in all crimes in which they were previously in place, and it adds a couple of crimes, including crimes of violence, for which there were no mandatory minimums. So in that respect, it's an improvement. It also requires that to the extent that any retroactive application of this is done, it's done on a case-by-case basis, with each case required to go back before the sentencing judge, who will evaluate whether the person in question should have a sentence cut as a result of the new lower mandatory minimums, where there are lower mandatory minimums. That would have to be done on a case-by-case basis, and the decision about what position the government takes would be made in each district so that each U.S. attorney would be on the hook and each sentencing judge would be on the hook for the outcome. Plus the fact that you have a lot of those people who have, notwithstanding the mandatory minimum, have other sentences on top of that that would make the question of a reduced mandatory minimum moot because they're doing time on other charges.
As a former judge, did you feel that the imposition of these mandatory minimums was somehow an infringement upon your ability to exercise your good judicial judgment? And if so, would you favor this kind of plan? You indicate that the society has a right to say it, but as a judge, that seems to be the principal complaint here.
The only way that would express itself is for me to think of a case in which I had to impose a mandatory minimum where I thought another sentence was appropriate. There was only one such case in the time that I spent on the bench. And my own view is if I were nimble enough, I could have avoided it. That was a situation where some young woman was caught with drugs in a bus station. She'd gone there at the behest of her boyfriend, and she was supposed to cooperate. She was told these drugs were being delivered to another city, and they were going to do a controlled delivery, and she was to be taken out of it. She was told not to go home because otherwise her boyfriend would find out she hadn't taken the package. Well, they didn't leave her with any place to go, so she had to go home. And as a result, she didn't get to cooperate. The government didn't send the kind of letter that it could send to get her out from under the mandatory minimum, and she had to be sentenced to a mandatory minimum of 5 years. Had I been somewhat more nimble, it would have occurred to me that the fact that she had to go home was the government's fault, and they should have given her someplace else to go, and therefore she should have essentially been considered as if she had cooperated. But in fact, she wound up being released under a program that was applicable at the time, and wound up not having to do the minimum of 5 years.
this is a case, I guess, where bad cases make bad laws in some respects. But let's talk when we come back, Judge. We have to pause for just a moment about the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists in this country and the threat that they pose, not least the idea that they might best be described as terrorist organizations. That and more with the former Attorney General of the United States, Michael Mukasey. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.